Orville Freestone Jr., Sunday PM, December 5th, 2010.
Turn in your Bibles to the first chapter of Romans. We got last time down to the 14th verse of this first chapter, still in the introduction and greeting section of the Apostle's letter. And before we finish with the introduction, let's note again that the apostle did not address this to the church at Rome. So evidently, the Roman church of today is claiming that they were founded by the apostles Peter and Paul. Really has no foundation. For there were evidently a number of different groups in Rome at this time, some of them Jewish, some of them Gentile, some of them Greek-speaking, some of them Latin-speaking, and various differences. He addresses it to all that be in Rome, were called saints. And then we got down to the 14th verse last time, where we read, he wrote, I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. His was a universal apostleship, and though he did not found this church at Rome or these churches at Rome, they came within his purview by reason of Jesus' commissioning of him to all the Gentiles. And so as much as in me it is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are at Rome also. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. This is a significant statement because it was considered a shame for one's leader to be crucified, and especially when the charge was that he was a criminal. In Rome, there is a graffito that can be seen to this day showing a figure hanging on a cross with a donkey's head, and below it is inscribed, Julius worships his God. And that is the way that the heathen looked at Christianity. That's the way they looked at it when it broke into the Gentile world. And the Jews, by and large, were willing to aid and abet that mindset. It was considered a shame. Christians were worshiping a shameful man. But here the apostle writes, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ because it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Gentiles. The power of God was one of the themes of the philosophers of the time, and many of the philosophers, Socrates for one, Epictetus, for one who is a Stoic philosopher of the second century, and the emperor, one of the emperors who is also a Stoic philosopher, they acknowledged the power of God, and one of them acknowledged, "We are from God. We have been made by God." Reflecting one of the earlier philosophers that Paul quoted, that "For in him we live and move and have our being." So they were acquainted with the power of God in creation, and some of them, like the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, was even willing to acknowledge the Godhead of God. Perhaps he was the great God who created the other gods, or perhaps not. But they acknowledged the Godhead and the power of God and of the righteousness of God. Epictetus wrote, "O," addressing all mankind in his discourse, "O thou who livest under the wrath of God and dost not consider it." So there was very much of the gospel that was revealed in natural revelation, but it was not the gospel of Christ, because that was the gospel of a condemned man that was ashamed. But Paul says, "I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek." The power of God in creation, visible to all, was a power of force, a power of might. Think of the might or the power stored in a single atom. And that was even speculated by the ancient Greeks, that the whole universe is made up of atoms and the power in the universe was in the atoms. But the power of God was unto salvation, and its greatness was manifest in its power to transform the human character. G.K. Chesterton wrote that the Christian doctrine of the depravity of human nature is the one Christian doctrine that is capable of proof, of visible proof. And I might add that every human being is Exhibit A, that the human nature is skewed in a depraved direction. One of the psychiatrists of a past generation, his name slips my mind now, said there is in the human psyche a bent toward evil, a skewed nature. So it isn't just Christians that recognize the sinfulness of man. So then why is a message of deliverance from such a situation so unpopular? But Paul said he was not ashamed of this power of God because he had experienced it himself. And he experienced it in a very dramatic way on the road to Damascus. And he knew in his own life how great that power of transformation was. And he knew that that power of transforming lives was in a message that we are given. It's not in a philosophical treatise. It's not in a psychological analysis. It's in a message, the gospel of Christ. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. The heathen philosophers, all of them admitted and argued for the righteousness of God. Most of them were contemptuous of the heathen gods and the heathen idols, though they paid lip service to them in the popular assemblies. But the righteousness of God was one of the themes that the philosophers admitted. And Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius both wrote long discourses on the righteousness of God. But they didn't know where to find it. Paul said here, this salvation is to everyone that believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, for therein, in the gospel, is the righteousness of God revealed. There's a difference in an unregenerated person's acknowledging that God, whoever he is, wherever he is, has to be a righteous God, and in having the righteousness of God revealed to us. For it is this revelation of the righteousness of God and all that goes with that message that is the transforming power of God. It is a message that transforms the human heart from within. For therein, that is in the gospel of Christ, is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. This is a difficult expression to understand. Just as in the gospel of John, what does he mean from grace to grace? A.T. Robertson said that there has been much discussion, and also Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, on this phrase, from faith to faith, and some heavy tomes have been written on it of all the different ideas that it means. But from a strictly grammatical structure, the meaning is most likely from beginning in faith to a life of faith, which of course agrees with the rest of the New Testament of the gospel. So this message of the gospel is reveals the righteousness of God by faith, beginning in faith, and it leads on to faith, a life of faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. This brings up an observation of Augustine, who said, I do not believe because I understand. I understand because I believe. And that is the way the gospel comes. We believe first, and then we understand. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed, from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. And this is a quotation from the prophet Habakkuk. Whenever you read something that is a quotation from the Old Testament, it is always a good idea to go back and read the context in which it is written in the Old Testament. So let's do that. Let's go back to the second chapter of the book of the prophet Habakkuk, one of the minor prophets, about halfway through the list of the minor prophets. It's following Nahum and preceding Zephaniah. The prophet Habakkuk is perplexed by what he has been revealed to him. And he says, I will stand upon my watch. I will set me upon the tower, and I will watch to see what he will say unto me. Now, he wasn't going to a physical tower, as is obvious from the context, but he was going to a tower of waiting for the revelation from God. I will stand upon my watch and will set me upon the tower like a watchman, and I will see what he will say. Not what I will see, but I will see what he will say unto me, and what I shall answer when I am reproved. And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision, make it plain upon the tables, that he may run that readeth it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come and will not tarry. Behold, his soul, here in context, is the Assyrian who's coming against his people, which is lifted up, is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. The Assyrians were threatening Judea, and the people of Judea were, as we might say, scared out of their wits. But here he receives this message from God that the just shall live by his faith, not in his confidence in the army, not by his confidence in anything, but in his faith. Now, this is just one phrase from one small book in the Old Testament upon which great doctrines are constructed in the New Testament. That's why it's important to know its context in the Old Testament. For it is quoted in Romans, where we just read it, and in Galatians, and in Hebrews. So let's see what the New Testament makes of this. For therein, Romans 1:17, is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. And this is the theme of the whole book of Romans. How we can be justified by faith and become just before God, and what that will mean to us in our life. So the theme of the book of Romans built upon this text, and it is all built upon this text, is that the justified shall live by faith. But who are the justified? Well, he leaves that hanging for the present, and he will come to it again shortly in the future. Then the next place where this is quoted is in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 11, where we read, Paul has been arguing that believers have never been under the law so far as their standing before God. Not even the Old Testament people under the law, as the quotation from Habakkuk would show, nor, as he argues here, was Abraham before the law was given, nor are we since the law has been superseded by the gospel. He said, but that no man is justified by the law in the sight of God, for it is evident, the just shall live by faith. That is, apart from works, apart from anything that we can do to secure a standing before God. The next place where this is quoted is in Hebrews 10:38. So turning to Hebrews, we read, for you have need of patience, verse 36, that after you have done the will of God, you might receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he that shall come will come and will not tarry. And that is also a quotation in the Old Testament. And the next verse is our quotation from Habakkuk. Now the just shall live by faith. And in each of these books, the emphasis is like this. In Romans, it is the just shall live by faith. In Galatians, it is the just shall live by faith. And in Hebrews, it is the just shall live by faith. Three different emphases showing us the source of our faith, the eternal enduring of our faith, and the adequacy of our faith for the Christian life. The just shall live by faith. Now that's the end of the first section, but already he is seamlessly gone from his introduction into his first topic that he takes up. Who is the righteous? And to whom is the righteousness of God revealed? And how is it that the just shall live by faith? All questions he'll take up in a couple of three chapters. But then he goes into his first point abruptly. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. So here in the last verse of the first section, he is speaking of the righteousness of God. And in the first verse of the second section, he is speaking of the wrath of God. Now, Epictetus understood the greatness of God. He discoursed at length on the goodness of God, or his providence to all mankind. And he understood the wrath of God. O thou who abidest under the wrath of God and knoweth it not. But he didn't have an inkling about the righteousness of God revealed. Now, he did have an idea of the wrath of God revealed because of what he said, O thou who abidest under the wrath of God, and threateningly went on to discuss how evil mankind could be. But the righteousness of God is revealed in the gospel of Christ. And that's a way in which the unbeliever cannot know the righteousness of God, because the righteousness of God that the natural man can know is a righteousness that will doom a sinner. But the righteousness of God revealed in the gospel, from the grammatical construction of the Greek and from the rest of the New Testament, especially this book of Romans, is not God's personal righteousness, but the righteousness which he bestows in the gospel. For therein is the righteousness of God, which he is willing to give all those who believe, is revealed in the gospel of Christ by faith, resulting in faith. The natural man does not have a clue about the message of the gospel. There have been several articles in the paper recently about evangelicals and what we believe and what we don't believe and what we should believe, and they don't have a clue as to who we are. But the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. Now, it's not written out in the starry sky at night in the letters of Latin or Greek or Hebrew or Chinese. but it is revealed from heaven to the heart of every person. For, again, the philosophers argued about the guilt of the human condition. All men know in some way they fall short of this standard. Well, I know I'm not perfect, but I do the best I can. They don't realize that the best you can isn't good enough. In the 19th century, during the Franco-Prussian War, there was an elite guard and division of the Prussian army who was the personal guard and regiment of the German emperor. And one of the qualifications for membership in that elite guard was that a man had to be at least 6 foot tall. How many of you here are just under 6 feet tall? Raise your hand. Just under? You couldn't have qualified any more than I could to be in that elite guard, because almost is not enough. So the wrath of God is revealed from heaven into the conscience of humankind against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. You want empirical proof of that statement? Let's go back to the time of Abraham, when the king Hammurabi codified Babylonian law. And he made it a crime against the crown for certain evil deeds. Murder is one of them. Breaking of treaties is another. Why do you suppose he codified those laws? Because mankind knew it was wrong to violate those principles. How did they know it? It was revealed from heaven into the conscience of the human heart. But the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. But the righteousness God gives is revealed by faith, unto faith, to all who believe the gospel of Christ. That is Paul's basic argument for all of the rest of the book of Romans. And these verses alone are enough to condemn unbelievers or to justify those who in faith will believe. So we'll take up from there next time.